Welcome to Bible Study for Progressives, a show where moderates, liberals, and leftists of all faiths and ideologies come together to discuss scripture, spirituality, and politics. We engage scripture in its historical context, plumb its depths for wisdom and guidance, and apply its lessons to current events and social issues. Whether you're a liberal evangelical, a New Age spiritualist, a social justice activist, or a postmodern theologian, there's something in this show for you. Come, be energized in spirit and mind to understand the word and what it means to be a spiritual person in today's world. The church is divided. The traditional line of division within Western Christianity between Protestant and Catholic has receded. The church is now divided between liberals and conservatives, and between North and South. The recent schism in the Methodist Church over gay rights illustrates the point. At its general conference in St. Louis this year, the delegates rejected gay marriage and LGBT clergy. Conservative Methodist in America, combined with representatives from Africa, Asia, and South America to defeat the inclusive One Church plan. The balance of power is shifting to the South. While Western Christianity is in decline, Christianity is growing throughout Asia, Africa, and South America. This shift is often described in the West as post-Christendom. How can we make Christianity more compassionate and liberating? Can we practice our faith and do justice advocacy separately with other groups, separate from our religious activities, and at the same time remain true to our calling as religious, spiritual, or ethical people to be a blessing to others and compassionate toward all the people of the world and to all of life? What future do you see for Christianity or for your belief system? We will talk about these and other issues with Professor of Philosophy, Joseph Dowd. My name is Rich Procida, and I write about progressive Christianity, politics, and the supernatural at modernlectionaries.blogspot.com. Let's begin. Christianity is still the largest religion in the world and growing throughout the global South. Churches in the South are predominantly Pentecostal or Catholic and socially conservative. Social conservatism will increase in the United States, if only through migration. America is just as Christian as it has ever been, but its growth is among migrant communities. These communities bring with them the versions of Christianity they practiced in their home countries. America has become a missionary field for Christians from the global South. It's Western Christianity that is in decline. The most common reason people give for leaving the church is that they do not believe the theology anymore. The type of Christianity coming up from the South may not be to their liking either. Christianity first split between East and West. Then Western Christianity split between Catholic and Protestant. While not a full-fledged division, there is now a corresponding split between North and South. Protestant Christianity splintered wildly. But today's division is not between Protestant and Catholic, or between denominations.
The division within Catholicism and Protestantism mirrors the division along geographical lines roughly drawn between North and South. The division in Christianity today is between liberal and progressive Christianity versus conservative and traditional Christianity. While perhaps not a full-blown division, there are differences within progressive and liberal Christianity. Some are traditional in belief and practice, but liberal politically, while others entertain radical theologies. Even within evangelicalism, there is growing discussion of justice and God's preference for the poor alongside their theory of salvation by grace and not by works. There is a growing social justice movement in the Western Church. Along with this comes a retreat from politics by others. The latter is part of the normal cycle for Christians when they feel under siege. What role is Western Christianity to play in God's mission to the world, given its declining numbers and relevance? And how can it stem the gradual losses in participation? The Western Church is still a powerful force in the world, and it isn't going away anytime soon. The question is, what do we do now? Both mainline and evangelical Christians have their own solutions. Conservatives commonly call for a return to traditional beliefs, something many Americans have already rejected. These are the same things their compatriots in Europe left long ago. Mainline churches took a different approach. They took the modernist turn and sought to explain the stories of the gospel scientifically. The Jesus Seminar, with the likes of Marcus Borg and John Dominic Crossan, exemplified this approach. The quest for the historical Jesus, the last in a number of earlier quests, assembled a group of multidisciplinary historical and biblical scholars and asked them to vote on which of the sayings of Jesus could be attributed to him and which of those sayings he probably didn't say. Their critical historical examination of Scripture added greatly to our understanding and interpretation of Scripture in its historical context. These scholars searched for truth in the only way they knew how, using historical and scientific methods. In the stubborn conflict between science and religion, they took the side of science in an effort to modernize Christianity. As a result, they clung tightly to their presupposition that as scientists and historians, they could not confirm or deny miracles. Their over-identification with scientific principles led them to reject the supernatural entirely. Some held open the possibility of life after death, but they all read the Gospels for their meaning regardless of their historical accuracy. In fact, historical accuracy was not the point of the Gospels. The Gospel writers were evangelists. Their purpose was to spread the word. The stories are more of a vehicle to that end than a factual retelling of the life of Jesus. While there are historical facts in the Gospels, the stories serve the broader purpose of promoting a new vision of governance, where there is only one God, and our leaders are merely human. More than that, kings and emperors are actually servants of God. Jesus taught that the greatest among us are our servants. Christianity was a radical new social movement. Its leader became the God of the very empire that executed him. It would grow to become the largest religion in the world. The truth these scholars revealed is something many Christians did not want to hear. The miracles described in the Bible probably didn't happen. This includes the resurrection and ascension. In fact, The whole idea of the supernatural is unscientific superstition that has no place in the modern world, according to these overzealous scholars. In their over-identification with their scientific training, they did the unthinkable and developed the concept of strategic atheism. This idea allows those who no longer believe in the supernatural to call themselves Christian. While we are right to question what we believe, we are wrong to cast the modernist fundamentalist split as the central conflict in the church today. Most Americans today have New Age beliefs, including nearly half of all Christians and many who attend church regularly. Belief in the supernatural is widespread across the United States. Like Newton practicing alchemy, Americans believe in science and the supernatural. Religion without the supernatural is philosophy. And spirituality without the supernatural is psychology. It doesn't matter whether one believes in the supernatural or not. Americans see no conflict between science and the supernatural, and most probably think that scientists should be investigating the supernatural too. Interpretation, however, does matter. On this, there are plenty of differences between traditional and liberal believers, as well as between evangelical and mainline churches. The overemphasis on substitutionary atonement and the obsession with saving souls needs to be balanced by a renewed focus on salvific action in the world. The focus should be on doing justice. This is referred to in Scripture as faithfulness and righteousness. The Hebrew and Greek words for righteousness mean acting or living justly. It is important to recognize that the concept of religion as separate from politics didn't exist in the first century. Kings and emperors were gods and sons of gods, and every nation was a theocracy. The Old Testament is a collection of the historical and legal documents of the Jewish nation, and the New Testament is a collection of the writings of a social movement initially referred to as the People of the Way. The Bible is just as much a political document as it is a religious one. The question isn't whether people should mix their Christianity with their politics, or whether religion should be a purely private matter, or even how we should live personally as Christians or as spiritual or ethical people, assuming one doesn't believe, as I do, in the feminist maxim that the personal is political. The question is, what will Christianity become? Will the church be an institution that promotes discrimination and violence around the world? Or will it be a faith of love and justice? In many ways, it is both, but how can it become more compassionate, more liberating? The Bible is the fountain of Western culture. Its roots run deep within us. If you grew up in America, you've been Christianized. Christianity is still a powerful force in the Western world, particularly in the United States. It will remain so into the foreseeable future. To argue that we should ignore or abandon Christianity is to fail to appreciate its ubiquity, influence, and power. What have Christians become? And what are they likely to become should current trends continue with or without significant resistance and change from within? By institution, I refer not simply to the brick and mortar buildings, but to the spirit, culture, and ideology of the institution. There are good reasons to believe that change only happens from within. If we had something good to share with others, one would think we would want to share it. The reason the mainline church has declined more quickly than the evangelical church, Mormons, and Jehovah's Witnesses, is that these churches have recruitment programs, whereas mainline churches do not. Evangelical churches are missional in orientation, whereas the mainline church is cultural and more about personal identity. Both have a problem with young people leaving the church, but mainline churches are satisfied to rescue those leaving conservative churches or to welcome those returning to their faith later in life in a quest for meaning. Many mainline ministers are engaged in some form of what I might characterize as palliative care, overseeing the gradual, inevitable, and in some ways not unwelcome demise of Western Christianity. Faith is thought to be personal and not political, and if it is political, you would be hard-pressed to find a congregation outside universalism that is engaged to any significant degree in justice advocacy. The unintended result of this approach is the increasing irrelevance of the church in people's lives. Many churches have grand missions, but it's difficult to see how they accomplish the church's larger mission outside their own congregations. Following Gushy and Stassen from their book, Kingdom Ethics, Following Jesus in Contemporary Context, I distinguish between charity work and justice advocacy. Many liberal churches characterize social justice broadly so that it includes charity work. While it may be true that social justice includes charity, charity work is what churches have always done. It's easier to do something the church has done before than to do something new and different. The result is that churches do a lot of charity work and little advocacy. Justice advocacy is neglected as the group becomes bogged down with organizing nearly every function at church, all broadly defined as social justice. I can see no better way to kill justice advocacy at church than to bury it in a workhorse group that takes on everything at church. Justice advocacy deserves its own committee. Dealing with politics at church is difficult. It requires the full attention of the church's minister and governing body, as it needs to focus on Christian ethics and public policy. It should work closely with the denomination, as most mainline denominations have public policy guides and justice advocacy resources. Churches should also work with the community so as to advocate with them and build coalitions. The church is an organizing institution. Some believe religion and politics should be separate, but we cannot sincerely compartmentalize our lives when it comes to God. As spiritual and religious people, we cannot separate our spirituality from our calling to be compassionate and ethical. We must not sacrifice our social ethics on the altar of personal salvation or enlightenment. To choose not to be involved in justice advocacy is a political decision. The church goes through cycles of political involvement, followed by withdrawing and regrouping when Christianity becomes too controversial and believers can't take the heat. Evangelicals who advocate for withdrawal from politics are like wolves in sheep's clothing. Their reaction is against the rise of progressive Christianity just as much as it is a refusal to address certain political issues at church. What they are really promoting is spiritual indifference toward impunity, corruption, and war. Some may argue that we can do our justice advocacy alone or with other groups separate from our religious activities. But if we are called by our faith to engage in social justice activities, why should we not do them at church? No one tells people to do charity work on their own outside church. Such a suggestion would be ludicrous, just as it is ridiculous to suggest that we engage in social justice advocacy alone. In the end, we fail to do God's will and fail to fulfill God's mission to the world. The solution is to be missional. That mission is social justice advocacy. We are to bring down the powerful and lift up the lowly, feed the hungry and send the rich away empty, welcome the stranger and treat the foreigner as one native born, and live and act justly as individuals, as the church, as a community, and as a nation. The Greek word for nation, as used in the Great Commission in Matthew, where Jesus commands us to make disciples of all the nations, is ethne. It refers to people groups, like ethnicities, identities, and nationality. It is the same word used to describe the nations of Egypt, Babylon, and Assyria. The translation for the word ethne does not refer to personal individual souls or isolated persons. Instead, it refers to people identified as members of a particular group and not as individuals alone. Jews, Christians, and Muslims, by virtue of their inheritance of God's promise to Abraham, are called to be a light and a blessing to all the nations of the world, to bring God's salvation to the ends of the earth. This is the calling of many faiths, to be a blessing to others and to be compassionate toward all of humanity and to all of life. We cannot do this unless we take action to end impunity, violence, exploitation, and war. Since we are called to advocate on behalf of others as Christians and as spiritual and ethical people, we should engage in these activities at church, just as we engage in works of charity at church. If it wasn't for Pope Francis and the work of progressive Christians and liberal evangelicals, the church could be headed south in more ways than one. Religious activists and reformers must work for a more inclusive church, enlivened by its mission to do justice. In this way, we love mercy, act justly, and march with the poor, the marginalized, and oppressed, to walk humbly with God among us. Now let's turn to our discussion. So, Professor Down, what role should Western Christianity play in God's mission to the world, you know, given its declining numbers and its declining relevance? And how can we stem the gradual losses in participation?
Okay, good question. I would say, first of all, that I wouldn't necessarily associate declining numbers with declining relevance. And the reason is that I think, in a sense, the decline of Western Christianity is a product of Western Christianity's own success. And here's what I mean by that. The reason a lot of people have been turned off to Christianity, I think, well, obviously a big factor there is just, as you said, no longer believing the theology. But I think another factor is just well, for lack of a better term, the liberalization of Western culture. And I think a lot of practices from biblical times. I mean, obviously, even if you go back to like 1950s suburban America, which we think of as being really conservative. I mean, obviously, the life of desert nomads is going to be very different from that, right? But I still think that as Western culture and American culture has become more liberal, people feel more distance between themselves and traditional Christianity. But I think that liberalization, and maybe liberalization is the wrong word, but that kind of trend in the West, I think, is actually a product of Western Christianity to a large extent. This is a theme I've touched on a few times on this podcast. You know, the way that there's this, I wouldn't really call it liberalism here, because when I think of the term liberalism, I think of equality, like the push for equal rights, which came out of the Enlightenment. And I think that really what we see in Christianity, especially in the New Testament, is something a little different. It's not really equality. It's more an exaltation of the oppressed and the victims. I mean, people talk nowadays about how there's this whole cult of victimhood in the West. You know, everyone wants to be part of a persecuted group so they get sympathy, right? And I think that's actually a product of Christianity. And of course, it's natural to be annoyed by the cult of victimhood and the shenanigans that it leads to. But I do think that overall, its historical effect has been positive. It's pushed kind of Western culture in a more humane direction to the point where people don't feel comfortable with some of the violent or socially conservative parts of Christian tradition. And so I think in a way, Western Christianity is still extremely relevant. It's just that its continuing effect isn't on the level of conscious belief. It's not that that people are consciously believing in Christianity, but it's still having this cultural effect. And you know, I have to admit, although I am definitely a progressive Christian, and I guess I would call myself a liberal Christian, theologically liberal, I am probably a little more conservative than Rich, right? Like, so I've never really been content with looking at scripture as just inspiring stories to motivate us to be better and more moral and work for social justice. I kind of agree with the famous Catholic writer, John Cardinal Newman. He once said the only kind of religion that ever appealed to him was dogmatic religion. Not dogmatic in the sense of being, you know, close-minded and judgmental, but dogmatic in terms of, in the sense of dogma, doctrine, teachings. If there isn't an actual God up there, then there's no point in me really going to church. So in that sense, I'm more theologically conservative, and for me, beliefs matter. But at the same time, when I get theological, I start to wonder whether maybe kind of Western Christianity's calling, its historical calling, the kind of the mission, its mission in the world, God's plan for it, it was that it kind of planted this seed of sympathy for victims in Western culture, which has now transformed Western culture to the point where, you know, that process just keeps going and doesn't need the help of institutional Christianity anymore. So I don't think that Western Christianity is no longer relevant. I think it's actually, in many ways, it's actually already done what it was supposed to do.
Yeah, that leads me to the question of what that is. What is it? Because I'm not sure that Christianity is still very relevant in its power over and its influence in the world. Yeah. And it's still the largest religion in the world. It's still studied all over the world.
Yes.
So, yeah, certainly Christianity is still very relevant. But it's not, but I think my point is that the focus on the afterlife has made it irrelevant to the people's lives.
Well, yeah. I mean, the supernatural aspects, especially the afterlife, is kind of irrelevant to a modern secular person's life. I mean, I'd argue that it's becoming kind of irrelevant to most Christians' lives, because most Christians, whether you're talking about conservative Christians or progressive Christians, most of them in their Monday through Saturday, they live like everyone else. Both in the sense of not being quite as conservative as Christians used to be, and also just in the sense of not really thinking about religion all that much outside of church. As a liberal Christian, I'm not really horrified by that or bothered by that. But yeah, I think in that sense you're right. It is declining in relevance.
And I did a little bit of reading just before the show, because I think the next show we're going to do is on understanding progressive Christianity.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons that we've sort of changed focus on the show from doing lectionary readings to taking on some topics is because I want to use it to help me do my research for my for a book that I'm writing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm focusing on my research. This sort of just came out, and I mean, I had some research and I did some research, but the actual background of the fundamentalist modernist split that occurred in the 20s and 30s, in which the what were called fundamentalists at that time, which later would be called evangelicals, became concerned with the modernist view of the role of Scripture or the authority of Scripture, the role of Christianity, which includes the social gospel, which was actually won the day back then.
Yeah.
But over time, eventually, the orthodoxy and conservative approach reemerged and started to take over even some of those mainland churches, which were in the 20s and 30s very concerned about the social gospel. And then even back in the 1800s with abolition. So there is a history, a long history, actually longer than evangelicalism, in which we did perceive the gospel as a social gospel, one for to create a better world. And we weren't so pessimistic about this world and not focused on the afterworld so much and the tribulation and prophecy. You know, and the focus on saving souls. It wasn't actually until the 70s, and this is me, you and I were alive during that time. I was just in high school, but I went through all of that. Don't realize that Falwell and the religious right was really a turning point, because before that, the evangelical church had sort of been laid back about politics, not as involved. But then with the rise of the religious right, all of a sudden, there's a resurgence of religious conservatism.
An interesting fact I learned recently about fundamentalism, well, actually, I didn't learn it recently. I've known this for a while, is that, you know, nowadays when people use the term fundamentalist, it's usually a pejorative term, a negative term for either creationists or extreme biblical literalists, right? Mm-hmm. But actually, that's not what the term originally meant. You know, in the early 20th century, it was actually a positive term that conservative Christians applied to themselves. And yes, they did. They did reject the theory of evolution, right? That we saw that during the Scopes monkey trial, of course. But that wasn't the focus, right? Nowadays, it seems like fundamentalists are obsessed with like the exact age of the Earth and all that stuff. And that just wasn't the focus back then. They called themselves fundamentalists because they were loyal to what they saw as the fundamentals of Christianity. So not like how old is the earth, but, you know, Christ's divinity, his resurrection, that kind of thing, which was being questioned by liberal theologians. So it was really, it wasn't about biblical literalism, really. It was this backlash against liberal theology.
And the denial of the supernatural and the attempts to modernize Christianity.
Between the modernist and the fundamentalist split, I'm definitely more of a modern, or let's say I'd be more comfortable having beer with a modernist, right? I will say I do think that it really, in many ways, the predicament Christianity is in right now is the fault of the modernists, those early modernists, because essentially, they created this choice between religion and science.
Okay, that makes big noise on the thing. I can hear it.
They made this. You know, it was the modernists who created this choice between science and religion. I mean, either you get on board with science, or you're some ignorant, you know, religious bigot, right?
Right.
And I think now, you know, it's actually made it difficult for progressive or non-traditional Christians like me to explain our position, because, you know, I try to explain that, you know, that the Bible isn't an instruction manual. It's not a map. It's not a blueprint. It's not an equation. it's a collection of many books and many different genres written by many different authors with different philosophies, different messages that we're trying to promote, different situations. And that if this thing is inspired, it's not, it's obviously not inspired by God, like whispering in someone's ear, telling them what to write down. We have to view inspiration as a more kind of subtle kind of influence. And now, as far as I can tell, that is, again, this is just my opinion, but that is the only intellectually responsible way to read the Bible, if you assume it's inspired. Now, if you don't think it's inspired, if you're non-religious or you're a different religion, okay, fine. But if you think this book is inspired, the only way I could see that working is if inspiration was kind of this subtle kind of divine influence kind of over time pushing the biblical writers in a kind of a holier or more just or more humane or more moral direction. I think that if we believe in divine inspiration at all, that's how it's got to work. And I have the hardest time explaining this to both to conservative Christians and to atheists, because they both think that I'm just not taking the Bible seriously, or I'm just cherry picking what I like out of the Bible and ignoring stuff I don't like. It's because of the modernists, now the only way we can read texts is as like literal instruction manuals or like a scientific text, right? That's what the modern world has kind of reduced our thinking to. I mean, it's on one hand, there's been great scientific and technological advances as a result of that. On the other hand, you know, so, someone like me just can't get a fair hearing because no one think of my picture looks too complex. It doesn't look nice and neat and logical, which is kind of the aesthetic of the modern world.
The idea that we have all these different views, that it's much broader than people actually realize, and that some simplistic ideas that come out, like the Bible, people think the Bible is written by God.
Right.
Some, you know, they don't understand what inspiration is.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the rejection of the supernatural, people thought they were being smart.
Right.
But they really weren't being smart. They were really just trying to make the Bible fit into their framework.
Yeah.
They didn't believe in the supernatural anymore. They felt this was the modern world. So they attempted to interpret the Bible for meaning. And I think some may have felt it was inspired and still feel it's inspired. But the ones who were scientific and decided the supernatural doesn't exist didn't think that. But even if you don't believe in the supernatural, it's inspiring. People are inspired.
Yes.
So, and even the people who don't believe in the supernatural recognize that people have experiences, and that those people will tell them that those experiences are real, and you can't convince them otherwise. And why should you be able to? After all, they're the ones who had the experience.
Yeah.
So, a person who says it was an hallucination or something else, that's the person who didn't have the experience, right?
Yeah.
But the main thing that we have here is that we've sort of gone too far. Evangelicals have rejected any type of social gospel, and it was almost a rejection of that social gospel. Why are we trying to help people? We need to be saving their souls because we're not long for this world.
Right.
And that ideology is proven, well, maybe we're not long for this world, but it's not because God's coming back. It's because we're going to destroy ourselves.
Yeah.
But what should we do? I mean, in this time of crisis, this is a time of crisis. This is not a time where the church can sit back and say, we're just going to believe things and be happy and not be involved. This was the problem with the church in Nazi Germany. It was not equipped to respond to that. And some people fault the church for that. The church today in the United States is not equipped to deal with a fascist takeover of the United States should Trump attempt to do that.
I think that's true.
Yeah. And what worries me now is that it looks like they're trying to prepare for war. They're trying to get the nation yes. ready for war.
Yeah. I heard about the talk about Iran. And yes, I mean, this is, of course, this is a fairly standard move for a leader to make, right? When they feel threatened, one fairly easy way to rally support throughout history has been to unite the people against a common enemy. Right? And so, yes, I have heard about that. And I agree. I mean, the church was not effective at preventing the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. Now, I think if the Trump administration attempts to start a war with Iran, I think in certain ways that will be even more egregious, because in that case it's clearly just to divert attention from the Mueller report. So I agree. I think, okay, certain churches, the Catholic Church, of course, opposed the Iraq War. So I would assume that it would oppose an attempt to start a war with Iran. And I'm sure mainline Protestant churches would also be formally opposed to a war. But you're right. If there were some kind of fascist takeover in the U.S., the church, I think, would not be equipped to deal with it.
Yeah. And I think it's not just to divert attention. I think they're planning this for the election. They want to rally the nation around the president at the time of the election. And it's very cynical and it's very dangerous, because they're going to be killing people so that they can get elected. And that's it. They're not doing anything else besides that.
Yeah.
And they're creating a false narrative in Iran. They tried to push the narrative in Venezuela. That didn't seem to pan out. Right. And now they're trying to do it in Iran. The whole time, Trump has been creating an enemy at the border, using that to try and rally. And they say he's trying to rally his base. He's really trying to rally Americans, white Americans. But even if it wasn't this particular situation we're in, the climate crisis, I mean, this is a crisis
you hit it right there. Noam Chomsky recently, you know, the linguist, recently made some statement that the Republican Party is the most dangerous organization in human history. And of course, I think part of what he was thinking about there was the current climate crisis. You know, if we don't do something about that, that's going to be, in the long run, it could be worse than any war, worse than, you know, epidemics. You know, it would cause epidemics because of the, as temperatures increase, there would be more tropical diseases and stuff. He got some pushback from that, including from some Democrats who thought, oh, wait a minute, I mean, the Republican Party's not as dangerous as like Nazi Germany was or something. But I think we really do have to take seriously, like, the reason I think people are more kind of have more immediate moral outrage about, like, say, family separation at the border, or the sexual assault of women, other issues like that, is that in those cases, the harm is very obvious and visible. You can just see it. You can see that that's bad. With the climate crisis, the harm is so gradual, right? And in a sense, none of us individually is at fault, because my carbon emissions by themselves don't do anything to the environment. It's only the combination of everyone's that really does something. And so I think we're just, I mean, including me, I think we're all more complacent than we should be about the climate crisis. And I think if there's one issue where those who believe in the sacredness of God's creation can really should be able to unite. It's on the climate crisis. I mean, there are some evangelicals who are theologically conservative, more theologically conservative than you or me, but who do want action on the climate because they see that it's a big problem. So I think the environment is one area where the church should be able to take a stand.
Yeah. And of course every age has its dangers and it is an imperative in every age. I mean, when we're talking, we have the climate crisis now.
Yeah.
We have a rise of nationalism in the world. This is a crisis. There's a threat to democracy around the world.
Yeah.
But even with just war and impunity and torture and poverty, all these problems, and many of which have been around since ancient times.
Yes.
How can we really be Christians and just stand back and say, well, we're not going to do anything about that as a church? I mean, we may do it individually. People are free to do their own thing. But as a church, we're just going to worship and talk about our personal morality and our personal salvation. And maybe we'll get pissed off a few at things. And maybe we'll even talk about social justice at church. I mean, this is the huge failing of the liberal church, of the mainline church. There's a big focus on gay rights. Yet what happens, being gay doesn't make you a progressive.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so there's, right now we have a huge issue with abortion rights. Women are seeing their rights being taken away and they're pissed off. But we have these single issue things and we don't see the interconnections. We don't, the gays see, oh, we're in church now and everything's okay, until suddenly it comes around and, oh no, we're not acceptable to the Methodist Church anymore. Until we start going backwards, we need to be able to step out of our own personal interest and our own personal groups and actually advocate on behalf of others. I think that's where Zizek comes in and sort of says, change has to happen from within. That's the only way change happens, is one way, because each ideology has built in its own critique already. Even if we're not in a crisis, we still have enough of evil in the world that Christians should be doing something about it. And I think they've just taken a step too far to ignore that.
I agree. And so even if we don't talk about things like the climate crisis, you're right. So, I think you're right that we need to look at the interconnection between issues. That's the only way we'll really get to the root of them. I'm afraid I don't really have much insight to offer there, but aside from the kind of the interconnection of all these issues, I think there are some specific pressure points where the church could do important work. So one idea that has been tossed around, I grew up Catholic and I'm still kind of have one foot in that world. So I do know that several popes have called for a global jubilee in which the debts of poor countries would be abolished. And I think if we could get a movement going within the church to really push for that, I think that could be one of the best things the church could do. Because the fact is, it's people think that what poor countries need is charity, but they don't need charity. They need for us to get out of the way, because one major reason a lot of these countries are so poor is because they at one point borrowed money from richer countries and now they're buried under debt. And in many cases, they've paid off the principal like multiple times, but because of compound interest, the debt just keeps growing. And so they don't have money to invest in infrastructure, in, you know, job creation, that kind of thing. Also, oftentimes, in exchange for debt forgiveness, richer countries will pressure poor countries into, well, they'll pressure debtor countries into abolishing trade restrictions so that the richer countries can sell all, companies based in the richer countries can sell all their stuff in the poor to the poorer countries with no restrictions. Now, actually, that sort of free trade can be beneficial to developed countries once they've reached a certain point, but you have to let a country, if a country is not developed, you have to let its own internal economy develop to the point where it can compete effectively in the global economy. And with these kind of unequal free trade deals, it's impossible for these poor countries to do it. So I think you know, the emphasis we always put on sending food or blankets or all these things to third world countries, I think is actually maybe the wrong approach. We should be focusing on getting out of their way, on canceling their debt. And I think that's one place where the church could do good work.
Yeah, we need to move away from, not necessarily move away from charity, but not see charity as a solution, but as a stopgap measure, and see the solutions as really about public policy.
Yes, I agree.
This has been Bible Study for Progressives. If you enjoyed the program, please subscribe to our podcast or put us in your favorites and write a 5-star review. Tell your friends about us and share us on social media. Follow us on Facebook and click the donate button at modernlectionaries.blogspot.com. Your support will help us reach more people, produce more and better shows, and cover the cost of production. Feel free to send me a note or comment on the show. I would love to hear from you. Until next time, this is Rich Procida. Thank you for listening.